And now, Pastor Comparé.
Thank you. Today I want to talk about lost foundations. Today, most churchgoers will say that they believe the Bible, but the question is, what Bible? If pinned down to specific answers, they will discount the Old Testament about 90%. They are skeptical of its history. They give no credence to its miracles. They know nothing but utter confusion as to its prophecies, and they reject its laws, claiming that these were repudiated by the New Testament. For their beauty of language, they will accept a few of the Psalms, those which are not controversial, which couldn't offend even the most wicked. But they reject all the others which sternly call the Christian to duties he wants to evade. Ask them, what else? And they can point to nothing. They will, however, say they are New Testament Christians. Well, what about the New Testament? Challenge them to produce from it the basis of their faith. They will confidently assert several doctrines, but they won't be able to find the source of them in the New Testament. However, their preacher told them that these are Christian. In fact, no one can find certain of these doctrines in the Bible, for the real author of a number of doctrines now being taught as Christian is not Matthew nor John, not Mark nor Peter, not Luke nor Paul, but Karl Marx. Some of the most monstrous evils of the age, cancers which have recently sprung up to attack the very existence of our civilization and our race, such as world government ruled by pagan and satanic powers, these are now being taught by many in the name, which they have falsely taken, of religion. They're being taught as a so-called Christian duty to destroy everything that has made us great and brought civilization to the world, and in its place to enthrone in power everything evil and debasing against which we have had to fight throughout the centuries. Only a rejection of the Bible can account for this, because it certainly does not come out of the New Testament. Its real purpose is to destroy the laws given by God. People who have been misled into the belief that the New Testament repealed all of God's laws, nullified all of His promises, and discarded His prophecies are really saying that the Old Testament is nothing but the record of God's mistakes, which He finally had to abandon and make a fresh start on something that He was able to handle. But you can't found a religion on a God who was too mistaken to know He was wrong and too weak to carry out His will. If that belief about the Old Testament were true, then we would have no religion. And since it is false, then it's time we got rid of it. Christianity is not something new, resting upon the empty air without foundation. It is based upon the solid bedrock of God's promises and purposes before time began. Its foundations are Moses and Elijah, David and Isaiah, Ezekiel and Daniel. In short, the Old Testament as well as the New. It is because we have lost these foundations that today many are trying to build the shaky structure of their belief on shifting sands, and find that they have only built juvenile delinquency and racial suicide and a foreign policy containing far too much of cowardice and treason, by which for many years we have retreated in shameful cowardice before the advance of communism, while we bleated about our Christian duty to coexist with evil on terms dictated by Satan, and by which we negotiate agreements to put all civilization completely under the rule of barbarians and outright savages. Before these disasters extinguish all the light we ever had, it is time to re-examine the whole problem, to find again our lost foundations. What Bible? All of it, both the Old and New Testaments. It is all one book, and no man can understand either half without the other. There is just as much Christianity in the Old Testament as there is in the New. though it is harder to understand, because there it still looked to the future, to events which had not yet happened at that time, and it appears there in the form of prophecies, rituals, and symbols. But when you understand these, it is all there. The best proof of the genuineness of the Old Testament is the fact that the New Testament fulfilled everything that the Old had prophesied and promised. And the best proof of the genuineness of the New Testament is the fact that it is the fulfillment of the Old. Jesus Christ himself used and relied upon this as the proof of his identity. He told his listeners in John 5, verse 39, "Search the Scriptures, for in them ye think ye have eternal life, and it is they which testify of me." And in John 5, verses 46 and 47, "For had ye believed Moses, ye would have believed me, for he wrote of me. But if ye believe not his writings, how shall ye believe my words?" And in Luke 16, verses 29 to 31, "They have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. If they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded though one rose from the dead." Again, after he rose from the dead and talked with two of his own disciples, he still used this as proof of his identity. For in Luke 24, verses 25 to 27, he said to them, "Oh, fools and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken." And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded unto them in all the Scriptures the things concerning himself. When Christ told his listeners to search the Scriptures, he referred them to the Old Testament, for the earliest book of the New Testament was not written until 7 years later, and the rest of it not until from 24 to 66 years later. What part of the Old Testament should we take as our foundation? The prophets? Of course. The law? Yes. Perhaps you've been seriously misled about the law. You were told that it was abolished by the New Testament? No, indeed. The individual no longer relies upon keeping Old Testament law for his personal salvation. Indeed, he was mistaken in relying upon it for that purpose, even in Old Testament days. Christ bought that salvation for him upon the cross. Neither do you expect to gain your salvation by obeying the laws of the United States, the state of California, or the city in which you live. But do you believe that these laws serve no purpose and have been abolished? The laws of God are still in force and still serve the same purpose, to guide the nation, the family, and the individual to peace, good health, prosperity, and happiness. Our present troubles are caused by our violation of God's eternal laws. Jesus Christ himself said in Matthew 5, verses 17 to 19, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whosoever, therefore, shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." It is still true, as the prophet Hosea warned us. God says in Hosea 4, verse 6, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee, that thou shalt be no priest to me. Seeing thou hast forgotten the law of thy God, I will also forget thy children." Do you say, "But my preacher told me that Christ abolished the law, nailing it to his cross"? The two verses you refer to are Colossians 2, verse 14, and Ephesians 2, verse 15, and both of these very carefully speak only of that part of the law which was contained in ordinances. The ordinances were the rules of the religious ceremonies pertaining to the feast days, the sacrifices, and offerings. These were done away with because they expressed the believer's faith that Christ would come to save him sometime in the future. After Christ had already come, the believer must not reject him by proclaiming that he was still waiting for a future coming. So, these ordinances only were therefore abolished. But it is still just as true as ever that thou shalt do no murder, thou shalt not steal, and thou shalt not commit adultery. The rest of the law is still in effect to keep peace, honesty, and justice in the land. Until we all know and enforce God's laws, we shall continue to have our present troubles. Because I am myself a lawyer, I can understand the perfection of God's system of laws as compared to any man-made laws in the world. I can see how God's laws, if firmly enforced by our governments, would clear up our troubles. I believe it to be of the greatest importance that you also should know this whole system of divine law. It covers all the economic laws for prosperity, all the agricultural and dietary laws for health, all the political laws for worldwide power and respect in times of peace, and for survival and victory in war. The laws for immigration and naturalization, and the political laws for the selection of the leaders who are to govern us. In short, all the rules to bring and preserve a high civilization. From time to time on this program, I will tell you in detail of these laws and how they would benefit you if they were put in force.
Tonight I thought I'd start on something quite different. It's too big a subject to finish tonight, so it's going to be this meeting and next month to get all of it. I wanted to talk about the gospel in the stars. Now, you all know that from time so early we can't trace the beginning of it, that all the ancient peoples knew the signs of the zodiac. And with the one exception of China, they gave to the principal signs of the zodiac the same names. The Chinese called these various signs the pig, the hen, the dog, and so forth, according to the Chinese mentality. But all the others gave these signs of the zodiac the same names, with a few exceptions on some of the minor constellations. Now, I'm not going to talk to you about astrology, because I don't believe there's anything to it whatsoever. But a curious thing, that from the earliest times, even these pagan peoples knew of the different constellations by these names, and as a matter of fact, what this sets out in the stars is the same thing that is set out in much more detail in our Bible. And it does not in any way grow out of or support their paganism. Genesis, of course, is not the earliest book in the Bible. While it talks about the earliest things, of course, Moses wrote that somewhere say between 1450 and 1446 B.C. The book of Job, we know, is still earlier, because with all of the philosophic discussion in Job about why he had his troubles, there's no mention in it of the law. And certainly Job's friends would have pointed out this law and that he must have broken to have gotten into his trouble. But Moses, in the book of Genesis, records the earliest prophecy in point of time when it was originally given in the Bible. It's Genesis 3, verse 15. God has summoned Adam, Eve, and Satan before him to give an accounting of their misdeeds. And in Genesis 3, verse 15, he says to Satan, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. And the same Hebrew word, zerah, meaning seed, or figuratively descendants, is used in both cases. So Satan was to have just as literal children as was Eve. And God goes on to say, I will put enmity between thy seed and her seed. Thou shalt bruise his heel, and he shall, some translations say, bruise thy head, some say, crush thy head. So you have there the first prophecy of the coming Redeemer, who is going to crush the power of Satan, but suffer terribly himself in doing it. Now, from then on, you've got a long gap, because that was approximately 4,000 B.C., and from then down to the time when Moses wrote, or even Job, which goes back probably 600 years earlier than Moses, you've got a long gap without prophecy. Now, you do have some prophetic material in the book of Enoch, about which we can't be too certain whether what we have today is the original or not. It's true that one of the books of the New Testament does mention that Enoch prophesied about the coming of God to take vengeance. But the book of Enoch has remained on the apocryphal list because the churches have not been sure whether they could accept it at face value as inspired or not. Now, in that long gap in there, from 4,000 to the middle 1400s B.C., what was to keep alive the prophecies that God had given? Now, we know, of course, that a much more complete statement was given to Adam and Eve than is recorded in Genesis, because you remember that Abel knew enough to bring the blood sacrifice. And you remember the Apostle Paul says, by faith, Abel brought a better sacrifice than Cain. You can't have faith in something you've never heard about. So the details obviously were given. But how to keep them alive? Now, we do know that the Adamic peoples living among the other non-Adamic races, discussing these things, some of the things they knew got out among the pagans and appeared in garbled and caricatured form in the pagan religions. Now, all the pagan religions of the world are alike. They say that man must make sacrifices to appease an angry god. We have, of course, most details from the Greeks, probably, but according to the general pagan theory, as well set out by the Greeks, if you became a little bit too prosperous, the gods became envious that you had all this. So you had to offer sacrifices that cost so much, they really hurt you financially. And so the gods would decide that, well, if you'd been punished this much for it, why, maybe you could get off without anything more. The Christian religion alone has the opposite. It has God making the sacrifice to save man. Now, nobody took the old pagan idea and refined it into what is Christianity. It's obvious that the higher idea, in the hands of people of no spirituality, was garbled and distorted into the lower form. Ancient tradition says that Enoch and Seth were the ones who worked out the signs of the zodiac. And it may well be because, as I say, among all the pagan peoples of Western Europe and Asia and North Africa, the signs were the same. and it goes back fully that early. Now, only one of these constellations resembles at all the thing it was named after. Scorpio, you can very clearly trace the figure of the great scorpion, his two pinchers out there and the tail curved over his back ready to sting. But as to the others, one and all, the wildest nightmares of a drunken maniac, couldn't figure out any resemblance from the star pattern to the thing they named it after. You look at any zodiac, the figures drawn against a pattern of the stars making up the constellation so named. And where the stars are situated on this figure is as random an assortment as if they were fired into it with a shotgun, a poorly choked shotgun. It's a scattered pattern bearing no resemblance at all. So, what caused them then, all these people, to recognize these things under the same titles? The ancients, of course, believed that the appearance was real, that the earth sat still in the center and the stars and the sun went around it. Now, you can tell, of course, at night looking up, you can see when the moon is against the background of a particular constellation. And they say the moon is in that particular constellation or sign. Now, the only way you can tell which one the sun is in is by figuring out the entire circle around the sky and knowing what one is out there where the sun is, because obviously in daytime you can't see anything out there but the sun. The first record that we have, recorded form, of the signs of the zodiac was called the Illumination of Bel. You remember that Bel was one of the Babylonian names for the god who was the deification of Satan. This was compiled by order of Sargon of Agade about 3800 B.C. Now, the Babylonians were not only astrologers, but they were also great astronomers. You remember, they lived in a desert country, no smog, no coastal fog. On those nights, the stars looked as though you could reach up and grab one. And they studied them diligently, and their larger temples that were in the form of a high tower had an observatory on the top. Now, the story of the Tower of Babel is garbled, maybe worse than most of the things, in your King James Version. In your King James Version, they say, "Let us build a tower whose top shall reach unto the stars." If you check it in the Hebrew, they say, "Let us build a tower with the stars on the top." In other words, in the glazed tile pattern with which this thing was covered, they would have the signs of the zodiac set on the top of it. And that was commonly done. We find in Egypt some ruined temples, such as those at Esna and at Dendera, where on the ceiling of the temple, the signs of the zodiac were painted in a circle. But Babylonian records show that they kept a careful record not only of eclipses, they had a record of the wanderings of the planets. The early name for planets meant the wanderers. They didn't stay in one place like the other stars. And they would be able to tell you when the star Jupiter was in a particular constellation. That is, you saw it against the background of that constellation. They left records also, not only of comets, but apparently they watched the sun through smoked glass because they left records commenting on the presence of sunspots. So while they didn't have telescopes, as far as we know, the old boys were doing a good job of astronomical observation. Very likely, they did the same thing as the Egyptian priests. Now, to be able to fix the calendar accurately is very important for an agricultural civilization. If you plant your crops a little too early because you got a spell of warm weather, you wind up losing it because they're frostbitten. And if you wait till a little too late, you don't get much of a crop by the time harvest is there. So to be able to keep track of the calendar was important. Now, as you know, due to the tilt of the Earth's axis, the sun apparently rises high overhead in midday in summer, not as high in winter. It rises over the eastern horizon pretty well to the north of east in summer, pretty well to the south of east in winter, and the same corresponding changes in sunset. So we know that in some of these Egyptian temples, they were laid out so that there was a little window or porthole in the wall, so located that when the sun reached the farthest south point in winter, when it rose at that point, the light of the sun would shine through this little hole and fall on a certain marker on an altar way back the other side of the temple, which told them that from that time on, the sun was going to start rising farther and farther to the north. In other words, you had passed midwinter, December 21st, 22nd, and were going on into the new year. So the priests kept track of the calendar, and because they were the only ones who knew how to do it, it gave them much more importance and influence. And probably the same thing is true of these Babylonian temples, that they were used in that way. We do know, as far as painting the signs of the zodiac or setting them in mosaic tile designs on the ceilings, that this was done in Babylonian, Egyptian, and Persian temples, because we have found enough ruins of it to show it. Now, they divided the complete circle around the sky, following the path of the sun, into 12 roughly equal segments, approximately 30 degrees each. And in each of these 30-degree segments, there was one large constellation which gave its name to it and scattered around other minor constellations. The word zodiac is derived from a primitive root. In Sanskrit, it means the way. Probably came down through the Hebrew sodi. In other words, the way followed by the sun, moon, and planets as they passed in front of the background of the fixed stars. Neither the sun, moon, nor any of the planets go more than 8 degrees south or 8 degrees north of the center line of this, the plane of the ecliptic. Now, the principal constellations or signs of the zodiac are Virgo, the Virgin, Libra, the Scales, Scorpio, the Scorpion, Sagittarius, the Archer, Capricornus, the Goat, Aquarius, the Water Bearer, Pisces, the Fishes, Aries, the Ram, Taurus, the Bull, Gemini, the Twins, Cancer, the Crab, and Leo, the Lion. Well, in later pagan times, they botched the thing up, perhaps intentionally, and began with Aries, the Ram, as the first of these signs, ending with Pisces, the Fish. Now, suppose you scrambled the order of things in your Bible. You began in Genesis with the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and you finally wound up with his crucifixion as the last part of the book of Revelation. You wouldn't get too much out of the story in that order, would you? It would look as though the thing was a final failure. So where you begin on this thing is important. And one mythical ancient animal was the clue to it, the Sphinx. You've heard of the riddle of the Sphinx, and there was a riddle of the Sphinx, and it's not the one you've heard about. The story was, you know, that this mythical animal stopped travelers in the desert and propounded a riddle. If they could answer it, they'd be allowed to go on. If they couldn't, why, the Sphinx would kill and eat them. It had the body of a lion and the head of a woman. Now, the real riddle of the Sphinx was, where do you start on this circle? Which is the first of the signs of the zodiac? Now, in the Egyptian temple at Dendera, the zodiac on the ceiling has a sphinx painted between the sign of Leo and the sign of Virgo. Now, sphinx is from the Greek word sphingo, meaning to join, to bind together. Well, where you join the beginning and the end to make a complete circle, that was the riddle of the Sphinx. And they showed the head of a woman. So you began with Virgo. You proceeded to the body of the lion, and Leo was the last sign in the circle. That, we'll see what this sets out. The fact that the truths of the Bible were set up there in a brief and general form so that people, as long as they watched the stars, would be reminded of these things, that is indicated in the Bible in Psalm 19, verses 1 to 6. It's a bit clearer in Smith and Goodspeed because, as always, your King James Version botches it up to say in some places the opposite of what it means. The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the sky shows forth the work of his hands. Day unto day pours forth speech, and night unto night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, yet their voice goes forth through all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. In them he has pitched a tent for the sun, who is like a bridegroom coming forth from his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run the course. From one end of the heavens is his starting point, and his circuit is to the other end, and nothing is hid from his heat. Well, all down through this period, they might forget some of the things that their grandfather told them, that his grandfather had told him, and so on, if they didn't have something like that to remind them of it. You people, how much do you remember of the stories your grandfather used to tell you about the things when he was a child and where the family came from and all that kind of thing? You probably paid no attention. And so with these important things. Well, we know that you must start with the sign Virgo. In all these ancient zodiacs, it's always the same. They show the figure of a woman with a branch in her right hand, and a stalk of wheat with the ear, the head of grain, on the stalk of wheat in her left hand. Now, the Egyptians said that this represented the goddess Isis, but they gave her the name Aspolia, the seed. Now, what's the significance of this, the seed and the branch of the woman? Well, of course, Genesis 3:15 said that the seed of the woman was going to crush Satan's head. But what about the branch? Well, there's several places in the Bible, obviously prophetic, of Christ, which calls him the branch. For example, Isaiah 4, verse 2, "In that day shall the branch of Yahweh be beautiful and glorious." Isaiah 11, verse 1, "And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots." Now that's unquestionably prophetic of Christ. Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6, "Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. In his days Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely. And this is his name whereby he shall be called, Yahweh, our righteousness." Now, the brighter stars have been named, and even today astronomers use the ancient names, some of them Hebrew, perhaps more of them Arabic, for at least 150 of the brightest stars. And their names are quite significant. One of the stars in this constellation, Virgo, is called in Arabic Al-Zima, the branch. Later, the Romans gave it the Latin name Spica, an ear of grain. Another star in this constellation, Virgo, Zavijava, meaning gloriously beautiful. Remember Isaiah, "In that day shall the branch of Yahweh be beautiful and glorious." Still another star, El Muredim, who shall have dominion. Now, whoever named the constellations and the stars knew the Bible story. Near the constellation Virgo is a smaller one, Coma. In Hebrew, it means the desired. The ancient zodiac showed this as a woman carrying a child in her arms. The ancient Egyptian name for this constellation was Shesnu, the desired son. Well, Haggai 2, verse 7, "And I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith Yahweh of hosts." So, as your starting point, you've got Genesis 3, verse 15, that from the seed of the woman shall come the promised Redeemer, who shall rule and have dominion after destroying Satan. Now let's go on to the next one of the signs of the zodiac, Libra, the scales. The Hebrew name was Mozanaim, meaning weighing. The Arabic name, Al-Zubina, the purchase or the redemption. Now I've talked to you before about the matter of redemption in Bible law. If poverty came upon you and you were forced to sell the family homestead or to mortgage it and lost it by foreclosure, you, if you got the money, could redeem it. Or if you didn't have it, your next of kin could redeem it for you. He redeemed it by buying it back from the one to whom you had lost it. And inasmuch as you could not part with the family rights to the homestead longer than until the next Jubilee year, if at the time you sold your property there were 20 years left until Jubilee, why, the purchaser got the right to keep the property for 20 years. After 5 years, your relative decided he'd redeem it for you. So there remained now 15 years of the 20 unexpired. So he would pay 3/4 of the original price and buy it back, redeem it for you. Now, it's significant here. You have the scales, but with the Arabic name, purchase or redemption. You simply cannot make out in the star pattern anything resembling the scales. You know how the ancient scale was. You had a horizontal beam suspended from the middle. And at each end, you had 3 cords going down holding a shallow, flat pan in which the things to be weighed were placed. Well, this is drawn as a scale set down flat on the ground. In other words, the beam is lying on the ground. Nearby are these 2 pans and the cords tangled around. You can find 3 stars that would fit in the circle of the rim of one of the pans. Other than that, you can't find anything that remotely suggests the way they show the sign of the zodiac. It doesn't look like scales any more than Virgo looks like the figure of a woman. There are 3 very bright stars in this constellation Libra. The brightest is named Zubin al-Janubi, the price which is deficient. In other words, the price that any man can pay, his own death, is not enough for his own redemption. The next brightest star, Zubin al-Kamali, the price which covers. Now, you look up in your Old Testament where forgiveness of sins is discussed. The Bible's idea of pardon for your sin is not merely that God remembers what you did but just withholds the punishment. The Bible idea is that it is covered up or blotted out. It is no longer seen. And therefore, when it's talking about forgiveness of your sins and that sort of thing, the Hebrew word used means to cover. The price which covers. That's the price paid by Jesus Christ on the cross. And the third brightest star, Zubin al-Aqrab, the price of the conflict. The conflict between Jesus Christ and Satan and the frightful price that he paid in that conflict. Incidentally, among the old Akkadians, the name for the month corresponds